Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 28th of September. We're going to be talking about close to $10 million grant that Milwaukee Public Schools received. Word came last week that they will be receiving the money from the Federal Teacher Incentive Fund from the U.S. Department of Education to develop a merit pay system at 16 schools. MPS will partner with the National Institute for Excellence in Teaching to implement the project support and rewards for teacher effectiveness. The superintendent, the new superintendent of MPS, Dr. Gregory Thornton, said, "We greatly appreciate being chosen from national competition for this grant. We plan to work closely with our partners in the Milwaukee Teachers Education Association and the Administrators and Supervisors Council on this opportunity for students, teachers, school leaders, and the community. It's an important opportunity to re-engineer and reform the way we support staff and students." We'll be talking about merit pay this hour of the program with Professor Michael Apple, who's professor of curriculum and instruction and educational policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He teaches courses in curriculum theory and research and in the sociology of curriculum. His major interests lie in the relationship between culture and power in education. And he says that he's actually pleased when school systems such as Milwaukee get funding, especially in times of fiscal crises. But he is not a supporter of the kinds of performance pay policies that have been imposed on Wisconsin in order to get federal money. We'll have a lively conversation. Education is all over the place this week. The president calling for a longer school year and merit pay. There have been some private benefactors who have given school districts in the country enormous amounts of money for improving teacher performance. The big question, I think, is how do we determine that? How are you to determine whether or not a teacher should get more money? What about all of those areas that really aren't tested very much? And those include, usually it's math and English that are tested frequently. What about other forms of learning? We'll talk about all of that this hour and welcome your phone calls. I assume we will get many of them. The number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you would like to send us an email, you could do that. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Professor Michael Apple, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, it's a pleasure to see you again.
Yeah, nice to have you on the air. We'll have a lively discussion, I'm sure. You know, I'm wondering about the timing of all of this. Can you tell me why all of a sudden front and center is merit pay and charter schools and TV networks doing huge discussions of why it is that schools are so bad? We seem to be in this time where everybody's thinking that schools are awful and we have to do something, so this is what we're going to do. Are they as bad as everybody is saying?
Well, we have more than one school system in the United States. For the schools of people who are relatively affluent, we have one of the best school systems in the world.
Mm.
For schools that are in poor areas or in poor rural areas, they're in crisis. So it depends on what school we're talking about. It's also, I think, dominant groups and powerful financial groups have been very, very good about shifting the crisis away from things like banks and the economic crisis onto things like teachers and schools. Now, when I say this, I want to be very cautious. Some schools are really in crisis, and I think we'd have to be blind not to see what's happening in terms of what's called the achievement gap and
right,
like that in schools. So I don't want to, throughout this hour, I don't want to be misinterpreted as saying everything is fine in the schools of the United States. But we have to ask, in a time when those jobs are fleeing like crazy, where people's lives are in real crisis, where farms are going under, where people are really feeling as if their whole future is at stake, we shift the blame onto the school. Schools don't create jobs. So when there's no jobs there, it's sort of hard for the school to compensate for that. So it's a complicated kind of set of reasons. Another would be Mr. Obama himself. He is from Chicago. Chicago schools, even when Duncan was the superintendent there, were in crisis. So I think there is this issue about how President Obama also sees education.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about MeritPay for a moment. This is a big chunk of money that MPS is going to be receiving to develop a MeritPay system at some 16 schools. Do you have any idea, have other districts done this, how schools will be chosen, and how in the world it will be determined who gets more money?
How much time do we have?
We have an hour.
I know. So, first of all, there is no evidence whatsoever, none whatsoever, to show that performance pay actually will benefit kids' learning. The latest research that comes out of Tennessee, basically, which is quite good research, shows that it makes very little difference, that it doesn't affect teachers pro or con, and it certainly doesn't affect the achievement scores of kids. So a lot of this becomes a more complicated discussion about the way in which people want to transform teachers and teaching. It's pretty disrespectful of the hard work of teachers right now. Teachers are working probably about 58 to 60 hours a week. This myth that they come in just as the kids are going in and then they leave before the school bus leaves is pretty much a fiction. So part of this is empirical. That is, do we have any evidence that this is going to go on in a way that will benefit kids? The selection of the schools, that's going to be hard. I can imagine the backroom deals in some cities that have gone on. I also know that in Milwaukee, which is a highly politicized place right now, it's going to require immense and I think pretty controversial discussions between the teachers union, community activists, the school administration, and probably DPI. In terms of what this means, I think that, again, what will happen is that we'll have more and more money determining what policies are. And in times of economic crisis, we understand that, but it's the worst way to make decisions. And we also know that the tail of the test will wag the dog of the teacher. We'll have less creative curriculum. When this has been tried elsewhere occasionally, it's actually led to more dropouts in other nations. It's been going on in England for a while, as an example.
Oh, it has. And how do you determine whether or not a teacher, because we don't test these subjects of art or a band teacher, is deserving of an increase in salary, merit pay?
This is a real difficult issue. First of all, right now, under No Child Left Behind, we basically said there were two classes we would test, math and reading. Now, I say reading because it's not literacy. It's not this wide range of will a kid like to read books. It's simply largely basic skills about whether you can decode language with very little research to back that up. And we know from Texas, where this was first tried before President Bush became president, it was tried in Houston, etc., that for poor kids in particular, kids got drill and kill because teachers' feet and principals' feet were held to the fire of the tests in many ways, that there was almost nothing else taught. There was very little music, very little science, etc. So science will now be tested. We'll have three subjects. And schools will get a little more credit for raising children's scores on the tests overall, even if they don't make adequate yearly progress. But by and large, what will happen, I think, is that the same things that happened in Texas. The tail of the test will wag the dog of policy, and money will determine what goes on. Now, there are a number of problems with this that I hope we get into, but again, I'm not optimistic about what will happen on these kinds of policies.
Mm-hmm. And is there, was Milwaukee given this money, do you think, partially because they had applied, Wisconsin had applied for Race to the Top funds a couple times and they didn't make the cut, so we got money for MPS just as a second place prize?
This the secret garden behind closed doors of how money is awarded is exactly that. It's a secret garden. Obviously, a lot of states were very, very angry about what went on with the money going to Race to the Top. So it was largely East Coast schools and East Coast states. Many, many states were forced against their wishes to change their legislation so that they could have performance pay for teachers. Wisconsin being one of them, it was not legal to do that before. Wisconsin changed its rules. And in some ways, this has created a crisis in legitimacy for the Secretary of Education in particular, who has been under great pressure to show that this is going to be done equitably. So whether it's because we've got an election coming up in Wisconsin, we want to show that we're doing something,
right,
or whether it's because Wisconsin wrote a good proposal, that's a secret. But again, $10 million is a lot of money for a school district that is in financial crisis. Now, when factories move from the whole area around Milwaukee to China or to Mexico, et cetera, there's no jobs. Teachers are being threatened with layoffs throughout the country, from 100,000 to 300,000 teachers. This stuff begins to look larger than actually the money. You're hoping that your foot is now in the door, that you'll get more money later on.
Mm-hmm. You know, I may be wrong about this, Professor Apple, but it seems that one of the underlying messages that you're getting from people who are concerned about public schools, not all of them, but many of them, is that we've got a lot of bad teachers in the system and we can't get rid of them and the unions are defending them and we need to just sort of clean house and put people in those positions who really want to work.
Well, and this is going on not just in schools. So the New York Times yesterday, if I remember correctly, I think it was yesterday, had an article about the privatization of libraries.
Yes.
And one of the person who owns the profit-making firm, who is now running about 63 library systems in the United States, said exactly the same thing. Look, people have been showing up for work and not working for 35 years. Now they're going to have to work. I would ask anyone who takes this statement seriously to spend a week in an inner city or rural school. The amount of emotional labor, the hours that have to be put in, the fact that teachers now have to compensate for no jobs, little money, no health care, horrible housing, all kinds of things, that they have to be nurse, doctor, mm-hmm. social worker, psychologist, as well as try and teach all this stuff for the test, all at the same time. I would like them to spend just a little time trying to do that labor. Now, there is no doubt in my mind that there are some teachers who should not be there. But I would say the same thing about professors. I would say the same things about doctors and lawyers and legislators and people who work on electric power plants, etc. And as I mentioned earlier, this is a way in which economically extraordinarily powerful groups. And if you look where the money is coming from, the private money, it often is coming from quite wealthy foundations and quite rich folks. This is a way sometimes of shifting the blame onto the schools in a way that I think actually is a bit unethical at times.
Mm-hmm. So how do schools, and MPS really falls into that category, as do many poor rural schools, which you just mentioned, how do schools deal with all that they have to compensate for when there's such a vast difference between rich districts and poor districts? How do you compensate for teachers who need to be nurses, doctors, social workers, et cetera? Do you just skip merit pay, just pay those teachers more money because they have to serve all those roles?
Well, I don't think the answer is not simply throwing more money into schools. I mean, schools are certainly in an economic crisis, and you can't have a race to the top. That is a sense in which we must become number one, which is also part of the problem, by the way, this sort of international competition. But you can't be number one if you're not willing to pay. We actually pay less per student than many, many other nations. But there is this sense in which, in order to fix this, we have to fix things outside the schools. But teachers themselves, while I would love to see teachers paid for the hours that they're working, which, as I mentioned, is much more, there's also a sense in which this is relatively punitive. So what we will say is we will find those 10% or 20% of the teachers who deserve extraordinary salaries, provided they give up tenure, provided they give up other kinds of benefits. There are other plans at work here that say we will use this not to penalize teachers or to establish differential pay, but we will find those teachers who actually do need some help. And as I mentioned, there are those teachers who could use some help. And we will spend a lot of this money making certain that we do two or three things. Lower class sizes, which has proven to be give teachers the kind of mentoring in class and after class mentoring from other teachers that make them better. These kinds of things, for instance, are what's going on in Finland, where President Obama and Arne Duncan would like us to look, actually. They have a huge and very successful process of school mentoring, of mentoring teachers, of reducing class sizes, of doing all those kinds of things. Now, I'm not opposed to an idea that says there are teachers who are really extraordinary, and those who are pretty good and those who are simply good, and a few teachers that we have to say, perhaps you should find another occupation. But the idea of this punitive form of assuming that all of our problems are just these bad teachers is, I think, to live in a world divorced from reality.
Mm-hmm. And once you mentioned international competition, what's wrong with that?
Well, this idea that we must be number one is, I think, rather interesting, because those nations that we are trying to pattern ourselves after are not engaged in something for which I think we should be truly patriotic. We are trying to do something that has never been tried in world history. We are building a nation and a culture and a school system from all over the world. So, for instance, in Los Angeles, there's 152 languages being taught in the schools. In Milwaukee, an immense and rich diversity that has gone on, making it, I think, a much more interesting city. Now, that will take time. It's very, very difficult. And in order to deal with that, at the same time as there's an economic crisis, we need to do some things that are creative, and it's not simply going to be solved by focusing on simply a couple of bad teachers and merit pay. No one's tried this before in the whole history of humankind. I think we should be proud of that. And in being proud, I think we have to understand also the depth and complexity of the problem. How do you do this in a time when there's no money to do it? And I prefer that we face that squarely rather than doing the rhetorical reforms, that putting in merit, performance pay is going to solve all these other things.
And it's so true. What you said is striking, and it's so true, the depth and complexity of this problem, and it takes on so many aspects of life right now. No jobs, no health care, recession, et cetera, and that isn't frequently part of the debate.
Let me give an example. I come from Paterson, New Jersey, one of the third poorest city in the United States of its size, and I grew up in poor schools. With very, very dedicated teachers, but I come from poverty myself. But there were jobs in Paterson. It was an old mill town that still had a lot of textile mills, etc. And if you did well in school, you graduated, there was a job for you.
Right.
Paterson, New Jersey now is the second largest Arabic-speaking city in the United States. It's actually been transformed radically in a very interesting way. But all the factories have moved. So if we think of Milwaukee or Racine or many of the places in rural areas where the farms have gone under, where the farm economy has collapsed in many ways, and then we say, okay, let's not talk about this. Let's talk about some bad teachers. It actually is to live in a world totally divorced. It's sort of a fantasy world in some ways. There is no way to solve the educational problem until we also deal with the connections between schools and no hope for the future for a lot of these kids. If you finish high school in Milwaukee, you will get about the same job as if you drop out. I hate to say that, but it does mean that when there's no jobs, it's sort of hard to convince kids that they should pay attention to it. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't focus on schools. But as you mentioned before, this requires concerted collective effort where we talk about schools, we talk about jobs, we talk about housing, we talk about kids' futures. And we're unwilling to have that conversation. Mm-hmm. Instead, we will let dominant groups say private is always better than public. There is no evidence to support that in schools. Private schools, voucher plans, etc., do no better at all than regular public schools. And charter schools do no better than regular public schools. And charter schools actually are more racially segregated than regular public schools. So while I am not, as my books would show, I'm not a someone who excuses the faults of public schools. But we've been told time and again that if you bring corporate models into schools, everything will be fine. Well, these same corporate models led us to this horrible depression that we call a recession right now. Maybe we ought to ask some questions about that.
We're going to go to phone calls. Professor Michael Apple is our guest. He's professor of curriculum and instruction and educational policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He has written extensively about educational policy and practice in a time of conservative restoration. And we're going to take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our conversation prompted, well, education is all over the place these days, but MPS received word last week that it's going to receive $10 million to develop a merit pay system at 16 schools. So we're looking at that and the questions that are related to that this hour of the program. Our lines are all filled, but just keep listening. You'll eventually be able to get through on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program this Tuesday, Dante Chinney will be joining us. He is the author of Our Patchwork Nation, The Surprising Truth About the Real America, the 12 community types that make up our nation. And, of course, we'll be interested in hearing how those community types will be voting in the midterm elections, and how many of them are up for grabs in terms of going Democratic or going Republican. All right, let's go to phone calls. Kathleen in Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just was thinking that it seems as if we almost have to solve the problem of poverty before we can really address problems in schools. I do remember a previous guest you had, Alfie Cohen, was saying that something like 80 to 90% of the time you can predict test scores and school achievement by looking at the economics of the family that the student comes from. And if that's the case, I'm just wondering how we solve that problem.
Well, this is a powerful point, it seems to me. I mean, Alfie is a friend of mine. I know him well. Actually, it's around 67% of school achievement is explained by income. So schools are dealing with much less of what we call technically the variance than we'd like to admit. But it's not an either-or thing. That is, we have to fix schools. There is no doubt about that. And for many of us, people like me, for instance, who grew up very poor, the school was the path to mobility, a path to a better life. And it still can be and is for thousands and thousands of children in their communities throughout the United States. But we are asking schools to do all of it by themselves. So we have rhetorical reforms, like $10 million for performance pay will somehow create a better life for these kids. I think that that's largely rhetorical, though, again, as I mentioned earlier, I'm happy when Milwaukee gets some money. But we have at least a two- or three-front issue here. We have to deal with poverty. We have to deal with jobs. But we also have to find ways powerfully to connect with kids, many of whom are alienated, many of whom do not see a future. Now, there are things going on that are quite productive about this. So as an example, Jim Bean and I show in a little book called Democratic Schools, where we take four schools, one of them in Milwaukee, by the way, a school called Fratney Street School.
Sure.
Another from Madison, which is Sherman Middle School, which is in a difficult, relatively impoverished area with a lot of kids on free and reduced lunch, some in another school in Chicago, another school in New York and in Boston. It is perfectly possible for dedicated teachers to work closely with communities, which is a key, to raise achievement scores, to have really powerful and creative teaching and curriculum, and to give kids a sense that school is for them. One of the things I think that's important is for us to actually show to, you know, to act almost as secretaries of these kinds of schools, to counter the stuff in newspapers, talk show hosts, etc., who constantly tell us that schools are horrible places, they're all failing. We have to do our work. And this is where public radio also needs to contribute, to point to those schools that are remarkable, that are doing truly powerful things in working on both economic issues and in educational issues. So, again, I thank the caller for raising the issue about income. It's very, very important. But, again, I think we have to do both.
And you look at, and I have a lot of familiarity with MPS because our kids went to MPS, with extraordinary teachers in many MPS schools. Talk about going the extra mile. These teachers have a lot to deal with, and they know it, and they're working hard on all kinds of issues, all kinds of issues. It's one of the hardest jobs around, I think. And what kind of, I get mad about this, but what kind of credit do they get? You know, they get blasted.
Exactly. And an example of this would be about 2 or 3 years ago, I was in New York City at a national meeting where I was speaking. And on Times Square, there was a billboard that was the size of sort of half a skyscraper. And it said $10,000 if you can identify the worst teachers in your school.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you. So this is the kind of stuff that we're being fed all the time. Now, as I mentioned, there may be, there certainly are people who have made a mistake in their careers who should not be teachers. But the numbers of these people are so small. And again, the formula that performance pay would like to put in place, which is basically teach for the test, will guarantee that teachers will simply focus on reductive testing, which are not supposed to be technically used for comparative purposes. And we will guarantee even more alienated teachers who feel like they're being disrespected and more alienated kids. We have information, for instance, on a lot of the places that have done sort of teach to the test kinds of things on literacy and reading, especially reading. And when you ask the kids who did better on the test whether they will ever pick up a book again, they say no, that we have destroyed their love of reading. So there are so many technical problems about just judging teachers' performance on these sort of almost mindless tests that I think that we have to be very honest about this. Now, I know a lot of people believe in value-added material, that technically, statistically, we can measure who's a good teacher and who's a bad teacher by having statistical ways of controlling for poverty, etc. To be honest, the technical problems of doing that are so powerful that it will take 10 to 20 years before we even understand how to do it.
Maybe we just need to make sure we have retroactive pay, because we all know that we have teachers who made huge differences in our lives. So 10 years later, we need to say, you were the one, here's a little more money.
Well, there's certainly, if I can speak simply personally, I would not be here were it not for my teachers.
I'm with you. I wouldn't either. Thanks, Kathleen, for the call. Rick in Milwaukee. Hi.
Good morning. I could speak on this issue probably for hours, but I suppose I'll have to limit myself to one.
I guess you will.
area. And that is the it's a governmental bureaucratic sort of jargon that's used in public education. It's absolutely as impenetrable as archaic Greek. So if you have very intelligent parents, you know, who are maybe doctors, lawyers, nuclear engineers, they don't understand this kind of language. So when they have some kind of problem with the public schools, what they do is they move out to the Gold Coast suburbs, you know, with their money, because they intuitively recognize the fact that the schools out there are run much better, and the teachers are more highly motivated. And these people are not experts on public education, but they just intuit that kind of feeling. And that kind of educational jargon really prevents any kind of meaningful discussion of the basic way that public education is administered in the United States.
Professor Apple.
I think he makes an incredibly important point. There is no doubt that he is correct that a good deal of the professional jargon used in schools is sometimes mind-numbing and sometimes simply rhetorical. On the other hand, there is some expertise that goes with education, and just like any other field, whether it's medicine or dentistry, etc., there sometimes is a specialized language about that. But one of the things that he points to that I think is very important is the way in which we marginalize committed parents. And this is one of the reasons I wanted to point to some of the things that are going on in that little book that I mentioned, Democratic Schools, but in Milwaukee. So let's take Fratney Street School as an example. It's in the Riverfront neighborhood. It's a very interesting school that has a large proportion of Latino students, a large proportion of Anglo or white students, some African-American students, and they set out from the very beginning of trying to involve the community deeply, to prevent white flight, to prevent what the caller so wisely pointed to, which is people who feel that they're not being listened to. Now, there are there are schools throughout the United States where this is going on, where parents in cities are not moving out to the suburbs because the schools are open, where they listen to parents carefully, and not just parents. Kids aren't just the private property of their parents. They're also community resources. So the attempt in many of these schools is to build a school, to create a way in which parents and community members are deeply involved. By the way, when we do that, achievement scores go up, teachers feel as if they're respected, and parents are not marginalized. And too often what happens is, I think, we tend to use this as sort of a public relations exercise. We'll say things to make parents happy, but we don't involve community members in the school itself. And that actually is a crucial thing to keep city schools, in particular, vital, with a mixture of incomes, a mixture of ethnic traditions and cultures, etc.
Thanks, Rick, for the call. Camille from Frankfort, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, thank you very much. What you were saying earlier about more money for teachers, more money for the schools, private schools not making any difference and all that, I really agree with you. But I have to say two things. One is to bring in more money for the teachers, excuse me, whose children test better is inviting corruption into the system. It's opening the door and just inviting it right in. That's one thing. The other thing I want to say is that if what you really want at the end of the year and at the end of the child's education is a child who is well-educated, who knows how to read and write well, who is ready to contribute to the culture, who has a good sense of him or herself and is what we need, then you will look at why Waldorf schools work. And I'm not talking about replacing public schools with Waldorf schools. All summer long at the institutes in this country, the public school teachers come out to learn Waldorf methods to bring them back to their schools.
Okay, let's hold it there. We have tons of calls. Professor Apple, I'd like for you to concentrate on the part where she talks about this could be inviting corruption.
Well, corruption is a powerful word for what we know has gone on. And this is where Diane Ravitch actually has been very insightful about what happened as people gained the test. Now, Ravitch, again, used to be quite conservative and deeply interested in all of the things that we're arguing about today. And she changed her mind. She had an epiphany. And she says that one of the things that these test-based curricula do, where they're high stakes, and teachers' reputations, and increasingly now their pay, one of the things that will happen is teachers will try and game the tests, whole schools will try and game the tests. We know that that happens. In fact, there is one nation in Asia where the test became so important that there were tests, say, at sixth grade, that parents would come in and there was indeed corruption. They would give teachers more money to pay attention to their children. So teachers who taught sixth grade almost doubled.
Oh, my goodness.
So they had to then shift. So a teacher who was a sixth grade teacher went down to teach first grade, and then you would sort of go through the grades until it got to be your turn again to get the graft. I don't think that would happen here. But there's no doubt that high-stakes testing, not just for kids, but now high-stakes testing for teachers, will lead to gaming for the test, et cetera. That's not a good thing.
No, that's not a good thing. Let's go next to Bill from Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I'm a former teacher. One of the things that used to bother me, it was a big conflict with me, and I think it's a big conflict with the public as a rule, is that on one hand, teachers feel that what they do is a profession, and what they and they want to be respected as a profession. Yet they have this union that, and Jen, I'm speaking to somebody who's normally, I'm pretty much a pro-union person, but they act like the United Food and Commercial Workers or the United Auto Workers. You know, they're there to negotiate pay and basically protect their membership. Whereas a profession, a true profession, say the lawyer, legal profession, or the say the American Medical Association, they're there to be a self-policing organization that sets standards of professional performance and conduct, and I think that part of the problem with education today is in terms of the relationship between the system and teachers and the public and teachers, is that they haven't figured out yet, is teaching going to be a profession or is it not? And in many ways, it doesn't behave like a profession. It behaves like a trade union. It behaves like a skilled trade. And I think until they figure that out, there's always going to be this conflict.
Okay, Professor Apple.
Well, I think that the caller has pointed to a real tension in teaching and teaching organizations. On the one hand, if people know anything about the history of teachers, there's a reason that strong unions were crucial. Teachers were among the lowest paid people with higher education degrees of any field. And because most teachers were women, it was actually quite a horrible and quite sexist way of teaching. Of dealing with teachers. As an example, women teachers originally, I've got a contract from St. Louis, where men teachers were paid $225 a month, women were paid $75
oh my.
In 1923. It required strong leadership to equalize pay, to get health care and benefits for teachers. The assumption was that women teachers would have men income and men's health care behind them. And if they got married, they had to leave, which is sort of a double-edged sword. You couldn't teach if you got married originally, but then if you were married and had the health care and the pension, you couldn't teach. So it was a paradox.
Mm-hmm.
So because of that, teachers' unions had to be very, very strong because of the way teachers were treated. Unfortunately, and here is where there's insight, it seems to me, in the issue that the caller raises, one can be progressive around union terms, contracts, negotiation about that, not wanting to give up any of those hard-won gains, and actually, because of that, not listen carefully to the criticisms from communities and others about it looks like you're only looking out for yourself, not for the kids.
Mm-hmm.
The best unions right now, and I think that many unions are moving towards this, are looking for ways to involve community voices in them, to work dramatically with communities, et cetera. An example would be GEM in Chicago, which goes by that's an acronym for Grassroots Education Movement, is a coalition of people in the teachers' unions with poor communities, with business leaders who are progressive, et cetera, to try and deal with reforming the union while still keeping the union strong in terms of we don't want to give up stuff like health care when everybody else is losing health care and pensions, and at the same time make the union much more able to deal honestly with community needs and sentiment. So there are movements towards that, but I tend to think we want to remember that there is a real attack on all unions in the United States. We have the lowest rate of unionization of any industrialized nation in the world, and that, I think, is a crisis. And people are being asked to work for much, much less, with no benefits, losing their pensions, et cetera, no health care, having to pay for much more. And unless we understand that some of the attacks on teacher unions are also part of that, I think we have to be careful whose values are sort of working through us. But again, I agree with the the caller that unions have to pay much more attention to the way they're being perceived.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Our guest this hour is Professor Michael Apple, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction and Educational Policy Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we're talking this hour, the stimulus for this particular hour was the news last week that MPS is going to receive $10 million from the U.S. Department of Education Federal Teacher Incentive Fund to develop a merit pay system at 16 schools in this district in MPS. So we're talking about it's not just MPS. There's a lot going on in the last few months about charter schools, about merit pay, lengthening the school year, the crisis in American education, and the best way to address that. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As you know, we have a pledge drive coming up, and we're close to taking off one day of the drive. We are not quite there yet. We have 51 pledges to go, so if you would like to have us take a day off, and I'm sure that most of you, oh, it's 43 pledges now. Okay, thank you, Chrissy. 43 pledges. Hey, we could do that this hour, couldn't we? Or certainly by 11 o'clock. Why don't you pledge right now, and then we can take a day off, which would be absolutely great. Go to WPR.org to handle that business. Let's go to an email, and this one is from Frank in Green Bay. Shouldn't administrators give the best teachers the most difficult students to teach? This, of course, that is, of course, where their skills should make the most difference. Clever students will thrive in almost any circumstance where their teachers meet average competence levels.
One of the things that goes on in many many school districts that has been a problem is exactly this issue, that it is the youngest teachers, the newest ones with the least experience, who often get sent to the most impoverished areas. That has created a crisis, and so many school districts are now negotiating with unions about issues of seniority, et cetera, and actually asking their more the veteran teachers to actually go into the most difficult schools. This, I think, is in process right now, and that that makes sense to me. But again, it's a difficult kind of issue. I don't want to say that if you've got a ton of veteranship, if that's a word, under your belt, that that means that you're better than someone who's coming in new and fresh with new ideas. But I think it's worth considering. But again, you know, a lot of this has to deal with, you know, with a focus only on teachers. It's interesting to me that we say so much about teachers, but we don't talk about parents' responsibility here. Kids are with parents much more time often than they are with kids. And if they're not, that's a bit of a problem. And often what is happening is we have evacuated the issue of what's parents' roles, for instance, in seeing that homework is done. That things are at, that there are spaces where kids are not on their DSs and Game Boys all day, where they're reading at home, where they're doing all kinds of things. And what is our responsibility, for instance, to neighborhoods and housing so that kids actually have space to do that? So, again, while I think the caller raises an interesting issue about can we get teachers with more experience into the more difficult schools, which is, I think, warranted, we have to ask, again, what are parents' responsibilities about that? What's society's responsibility for making it possible for kids to have quiet spaces, places to study, et cetera? And I think a lot of this has to do with the politics of race. Certainly in Milwaukee, I think we need to be honest about that, but in other cities as well and other areas, we tend to demonize schools and teachers in impoverished areas. And we are unwilling, I think, to face the fact that this is a society that still, even with a black president, we are not post-racial at all. We still are degrading our inner cities. We still are evacuating jobs. And this affects the people at the bottom disproportionately. So in the process of doing this, of getting teachers into the hard-to-teach schools, et cetera, we have to say what else needs to be done about these kinds of things. And then we'd have to face the history of race in the United States.
Mm-hmm. Skyler in Heartland, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good. I'm only speaking from personal experience here, but I just recently graduated college. And from my experience, what I saw from those attending the, or those moving into the educational field, is that they typically weren't the highest performing college students. They weren't the magna cum laude or the summa cum laude. And I'm thinking that the merit pay might be a good idea to target that more competitive-based, higher echelon college student to enter education.
Hmm.
An interesting issue. There are programs to do this, and certainly Teach for America is an attempt to take students from Yale, Harvard, Howard University, etc., and get them into classrooms. Let me speak from my own experience here in Madison, though a similar thing would go on at UWM and elsewhere. Our GPA, the entering grade point average for students in our elementary teacher education program, is between 3.3 and 3.7. That is a higher grade point average than almost all the sciences as well. So certainly for many of the folks who are going into teaching, they are doing it not because they couldn't do anything else. They happen to be extraordinarily smart, and they've done very well academically, because you cannot get into the School of Education here in Madison until approximately your junior year. You have to prove yourself for 2 years in what we call letters in science. So I'd want to be cautious of assuming that the folks going into education are not the brightest. That actually is not the case necessarily throughout the country. But let's also remember that for a lot of people who go into nursing or social work or teaching, they're doing this out of a deep commitment. And there is no necessary correlation between having the best test scores in the world and being able to teach it well. I don't want people in teaching who are not very smart, though there are very few of those, but we do know that simply native raw intelligence is not the answer, that you need the commitment, you need the skills to be a teacher. But again, I certainly would like to recommend to anyone who, whatever their GPA, who wants a fulfilling career that can make a difference in someone's life permanently, that they consider teaching.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such an important profession. Virginia in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi, good morning to both of you. So glad that I was able to get on again. I call in often, and you have such great guests on here, Kathleen. I want to talk simply about, first of all, I want to say all the callers that I've listened to and the professor are just absolutely right on the money. I have done a lot of volunteering. I've been in the public schools, helping kids, and incidentally, I'll be going over to what they call Fratney Escuela that the professor is very familiar with, and there is a bookstore called Woodland Pattern, which is right in that neighborhood. Excuse me, I'm in a writing group there, and I will be volunteering my time as a mentor for those children there. What happens here, as far as I can see, is that there isn't much mentoring in the schools. When kids get home, especially in the lower income areas, their parents are overwhelmed with their jobs. They don't have time for helping the kids with the homework, etc. They need someone, at least one person in their lives, to know someone is behind me, somebody cares, somebody is following what I do. So what we do is focus on their strengths, and you can bring out these little gems that we all carry within us in each of these children that they don't know that they possess. If I had had this when I was in school, I'm sure that I would have gone a lot farther than I have, although I'm very grateful to be where I am today. As I said, the teachers are overwhelmed. They have too many in their classrooms. Excuse me. Too many in their classrooms. As I said, I've been there. I've seen it. I've seen children in kindergarten being carried out by the teachers down to maybe the principal's office for a timeout or something like that. And this is in kindergarten.
Mm-hmm. Schools could certainly use a lot more people like Virginia. There doesn't seem to be a system in place for lots of mentors, because there are people who would love to help, Professor Apple.
I think that's exactly correct. And this is, you know, schools are a community responsibility, not only a teacher or administrator's responsibility. And in Madison, for instance, the Gloria Ladson Billings, myself, and a number of other folks have tried to deal honestly with how do we get people, retired people, community members, people who are artists or poets or
right.
spoken word people, mm-hmm. hip-hop people, etc., from local communities, doctors, lawyers, etc., flooding into the schools.
Yes.
That is absolutely essential. And the more that we see schools as part of the community, the better we'll be able to solve these problems.
Professor Apple, thank you so much for the hour. Most interesting.
It's a pleasure, Kathleen.
Professor Michael Apple, Professor of Curriculum and Instruction and Educational Policy Studies at UW-Madison. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up, and we'll return with more Tuesday conversation. So please stay with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.